This is recorded for the Purdue University Archives. It is an interview with the distinguished professor emeritus John R. Carling, K-A-R-L-I-N-G, and Robert D. Eccles of the Department of History. The interview is for the Purdue University Archives. Well, Professor Carling, let's start out at the beginning. Where were you born? Give us the story of your education and your graduate work, and roughly your professional and personal life until you come to Purdue.
Well, I was born in Austin, Texas, but some members of the family seem to believe that I was born in Mexico, and there doesn't seem to be any agreement in the family as to the date of my birth. I'm listed in Who's Who as 1899, but when we sold a part of the ranch not so many years ago, it came out that there was a record of my birth in 1897. One of my brothers says it's 1898, so there it is. So whether I was born in Mexico or in Texas, born in 1897, 98, or 99 is a matter of question. At the time I was a boy, there wasn't much schooling to be had in that part of Texas, but I got 2 years of schooling at a small country schoolhouse, part of which was still a log cabin outside of Austin, Texas.
Where was your ranch? The west of Austin, going up into the hill country?
Yes, it's going up into the hill country. And then we also had a place not far from Johnson City, or what became later on part of the ranch of President Johnson. Well, at any rate, I had 2 years of schooling, and then this school was closed, and just about that time, the Missouri, Kansas, and Texas Railway came through that part of Texas, and we as children were hired by the railroad to watch the cuts that had been made through the ranch fence so that the neighbor's cattle could not come in. And at that time, Father secured a tutor for us, and for quite some time, this tutor taught us quite a bit of the fundamentals of mathematics or arithmetic, reading and writing and some history, and also some German. And after the completion of this, I attended what might be called a small prep school called Texas Wesleyan College, which had been established in Austin for poor farmer boys who had not had much of an education. While I attended that little prep school for 2 years, I became associated with faculty members of the University of Texas who were teachers at this small prep school. They were very outstanding people in a way, and they imbued me and my sister to try to enter the University of Texas. This small prep school did not have accreditation, so that we were forced to take the entrance examinations to the university. I recall that I took 20 examinations in the course of about 18 hours. And I passed 12 of those examinations, which were recognized by the registrar at the University of Texas. Later that fall, I went to the university to try to enter, but the registrar told me that I had only 12 recognizable credits, and therefore I could not enter the university. At that time, I was 14 years of age, rather small, wearing short pants and black rimmed stockings like the boys of that time wore. And as I was about to leave, I'll never forget the registrar, a Mr. Matthews. After he had told me that I could not enter the university, he asked me what I was going to do now that I could not enter the university. So I told him that I would perhaps be a farmer or a rancher, and he says, for goodness sakes, don't do that. Go on in and register. So it was entirely fortuitous that I was allowed to enter the university at that age. And during the course of my years at the university, I studied the subjects in which I had failed in my entrance examinations. And when I was a senior at the University of Texas, at the age of 18, I took these 8 remaining examinations for entrance to the university. And so my entry in to the academic field was purely by accident. And I've always felt very grateful to the registrar for allowing me to go enter the university at that young age without full accreditation.
What did you major in?
At that time, I had no idea what I would major in, but I'd always admired school teachers because I thought they were the infinite source of knowledge, and I thought maybe I would be a school teacher. And so, in the university, I did not major in anything in particular until my junior and senior years. I was very much interested in law and public speaking, but by accident, I took a course in biology. And this fascinated me to such an extent that I decided I would study, take the pre-medical training courses and go into medicine. But just about that time, the World War was in progress and the United States had entered the war. And so I enlisted in what later became the Air Corps.
Now, may I interrupt? When you were at Texas, you just didn't study all the time. Didn't you play on any athletic teams or take part in any undergraduate activities?
Oh, yes. I was athletically inclined all the time. I was on the track team. I played basketball and baseball. And at the same time, I was rather good as a lightweight boxer, at least I thought so at that time. I was particularly interested in baseball because of the fact that the New York Giants and the Chicago White Sox used to always train at San Antonio. And our baseball training started the latter part of February. And by the middle of March, when these teams came down to San Antonio, we were in mid-season form, with the result that in our exhibition games, we very frequently beat them because we were in a good season form. And at that time, there were 4 young players who showed promise as baseball players, and we were invited by the Chicago White Sox to come up and try out for the team. These people were players by the name of Robinson, Ted Lyons, Bib Falk, and myself. At that time, it was extremely difficult for a rookie to break into the lineup, and it soon dawned on me that I did not have the ability that would make it possible for me to be a major league ball player. And Kid Gleason, who was managing the White Sox at that time, agreed that I didn't have great possibilities, and he advised me to give it up. So that was just about the end of my athletic career.
Well, I just wanted to know, you didn't do debating or dramatics or publications?
Well, I did do debating. I was so interested in public speaking, and so I did debate quite a lot. My idea at first was to be an effective speaker as a lawyer and possibly might go into politics.
It's a rough game in Texas.
It is that, yes.
Well, all right. Now, excuse me. We got you through college. What year did you get your A.B.?
I got my A.B. degree in 1918 and master's degree in 1919.
Well, now, did you go to war in the Air Corps? Let's get back to that.
Well, it wasn't the Air Corps. At that time, there was no Air Corps, and it was in the Signal Corps at that time. And we trained at what was the Old Blind Institute in Austin, Texas, and got considerable experience in the basics of flying and aeronautics. And then we were sent to Randolph Field in San Antonio for further training. But at that time, the war is coming to an end, so that was the end of that.
You went back to Texas to get your master's?
Yes. And then I was very much interested in possibly going abroad and studying there for some time, but the possibilities were not available to me. But I did get to Oxford University for a year. Then I traveled about in Europe and other places and finally came back to the University of Texas, where I was made an instructor and assistant professor. And I was advised that...
In what field? In biology?
Yes, in biology. By that time, I had found out that my interests were in that field. So I was advised by one of the professors that if I wanted to get ahead in the particular field in which I was interested, which is botany, I should go to Columbia University and study under Professor Harper. I did that in 1919, took my doctorate degree there, took a summer off to attend the University of Mexico City, and after the completion of my doctorate, I was made an instructor, an assistant professor. By that time, Professor Harper had retired, and I succeeded him in his courses, and stayed on at Columbia for 28 years.
Uh-huh, and your work was you specialized in botany, did you not?
Yes, the general field was botany. However, my interests shifted on to the study of fungi, and that has been my field of interest since that time.
When you say that you made the scale up the ladder for the next 28 years, it seems to me that you can't just dismiss that. Did you start to publish? And of course, you had to publish in order to get that. But what articles or books did you do during this time?
I did two books on fungi, and had in preparation several others which I didn't complete at that time, but which I've completed since. I might say that while I was at the University of Texas, I was studying the milk of plants, or what we call latex, and my master's thesis was on that subject. And although I began to study fungi at Columbia University, I still retained a great deal of interest in these plant products. And in 1924, when I took my doctorate degree, the chewing gum companies of America decided that they would explore the possibility of chicle, a chewing gum production, on a plantation basis in the tropical Americas. Dean Myers of Cornell University was asked to head up this project, but he was unable to do so, and I was requested to undertake this project for the chewing gum companies. And so I got involved in chewing gum for almost 15 years as a side issue to my teaching and mycological research, or fungus research. In 1925, Columbia University, which received a large grant of scholarship money from the chewing gum companies, gave me 6 months leave of absence for almost 12 years to go to British Honduras or tropical Central America to establish a Chico research experiment station to see if chewing gum production could be put on a plantation basis like rubber in the Far East. I went to British Honduras primarily because that was the only country at that time that had a stable government which would not be subject to change. The better territory to set up a station of this sort was in southern Mexico, but at that time there was considerable continuing difficulty in Mexico, so the decision was made to establish it in British Honduras. After making several surveys and investigations, we settled on an area called in the Orange Walk District of northern British Honduras, up in the bush where the chicle tree was fairly abundant. So I set up there an experiment station, built houses for Maya labor, and set out to test the problem of whether or not chicle production could be on a plantation basis. However, I found that within a year or so that this was impossible. By counting the growth rings of trees which were just about ready to be bled for their milk, I found that they were about 80 years old, and it became evident to me at once that it would take anywhere from 50 to 75 years to bring a plantation of trees up to where they would produce chicle. So I advised chewing gum companies that their project was not feasible. However, a very peculiar circumstance had developed. In surveying the area, I found that it averaged about 1.5 mahogany tree per acre. Now, the fee for cutting a mahogany tree was $8 per stump. We had paid about 75 cents an acre for a little over 50,000 acres of bush. So it was quite obvious that there was a great source of mahogany to be had from this area. Having paid only 75 cents an acre, it's quite obvious that the chewing gum companies, merely by selling the right to cut mahogany, would be making $7.25 per acre. When I advised the chewing gum companies that plantation production of chicle or chewing gum was not feasible, they said, go ahead and see what you can find out. And so I worked around in this particular field for a great number of years. And in the process of surveys and so on, I became very much interested in Maya archaeology, because there were a great number of ruins in these areas where we were working and making our surveys. At one time, making a survey in southern Mexico or in Quintana Roo and northern British Honduras, we accidentally found two rather large Maya cities which had not been on the map at all archaeologically. One of the cities we named Calakmul in the Maya language, which means on an island. We were somewhat lost on this survey And we decided to cross a swamp to what we regarded as higher ground. And we found out that this whole higher ground was occupied by a Maya city that covered about 104 acres. Later on the same survey, we found another city between two hills, which we call Noshana. And after we had made initial cuttings through the jungle and seen the extent of these ruins, we notified the Carnegie Institute of Archaeology, and Dr. Sylvanus Morley came down and made a further survey. So these two cities are now on the map of the ruins of the Maya Indians.
Did you dig in them?
Yes, we were very much interested in exploring the whole thing. And by that time, I had learned from experience in British Honduras with Dr. Thompson to read the initial series. That is a stele with the hieroglyphics.
Now, is this the British Thompson?
Yes, this is
a short, dark man, dark hair, about rather slender, about 5'7", 5'8".
Oh yes, that's the Thompson. You see, I'd been with him on quite a lot of explorations.
He's my neighbor in Cambridge.
He was.
Cambridge, Massachusetts.
Well,
yes.
He's still alive, you know, and he was on television in this television documentary on man and his origin about 3 months ago. Yes.
That's interesting. I hadn't heard of him. Of course, we didn't become close friends. We lived in adjoining apartments and said, how do you do, and exchanged drinks once in a while.
Well, that's very interesting. Both he and I were relatively young at that time. That's quite a number of years ago. Well, the upshot of the thing was that these two cities were intermediate between the older cities, Huachactún in Guatemala, and Uxmal and Chichen Itza in Yucatan. And at that time, the archaeologists generally spoke of the Old Empire and the New Empire. The Old Empire in Guatemala, the New Empire in Yucatan and Quintana Roo and the adjacent areas. But the initial series of these two cities indicated that the dates were intermediate between the two extremes, so that the whole concept of an old empire and a new empire was completely wiped out by these discoveries, so that now it's quite evident that the migration was north and they established successive cities as they went along. So that was the high point in what I might call my archaeological discovery.
No one has yet been, have they been able to break the language?
No, there's no such thing as a Rosetta Stone, and that's very unfortunate. It's probably due to the fact that the Spanish conquerors set out to destroy as much of the written things of the Mayas as possible to convert them from paganism to Christianity.
Works of the devil.
That's right.
The church has done that before.
Yep.
Well, this is fascinating. Well, now when did you cease making Central America your, in a sense, the headquarters for your experiments?
This was in 1932 or 33, I think. And by that time, my responsibilities at Columbia had become heavier, and I didn't feel that I could continue to ask for the 6 month leave of absence each year for that purpose.
By the way, we haven't put on the tape, what was the subject of your PhD thesis?
Well, nuclear and cell division in the Caraceae. This is very interesting how I did that, which happened to be studying the cell structure of some of the algae. But my algae got very heavily infected with something. And I showed it to Dr. Harper, and he said, you must study this. So I set to work to study the parasites of these algae. And when I thought I had finished, I took my study and the results to Professor Harper. He read it over, and I remember his expression in German, das kann nicht sein, that cannot be, he said. And so I set to work then to study it more in detail, and I found out that what I had called one parasite was a whole series of parasites that belong in different families, genera, and species. By the time I had done that, I had become a mycologist, a student of fungi. It was a purely accidental infection of the algae that I was studying for my doctor's thesis.
That's interesting. Well, now, did you have administrative responsibilities at Columbia? You said that you got so involved that you couldn't go back to Central America.
Well, I had more graduate students. I was giving more intensive courses. I shifted from, let us say, beginning courses in biology to graduate courses, and the teaching of those and directing the research of students was the principal reason why I felt that I could withdraw from Central America, primarily on the grounds that I saw no possibility of chicle production on a plantation basis, and after all these years, I had what I felt was sufficient jungle experience, and I was getting worse and worse from malarial infections and things of that sort. So,
never bitten by poisonous serpents?
No, there were all sorts of poisonous snakes in there, rattlesnakes, the yellow jaw, and I had several of my Indians bitten by snakes, and when I could do nothing for them, I always called in the old medicine man, and somehow or another he pulled several of them through. When I was down there, the Indians, I had about 200 Maya Indians working for me, and they thought that I was a medical doctor, so they came to me for all sorts of treatments for their various ailments, and one day a week I held a clinic. I had a white laboratory coat and some instruments and scalpels which I laid out and looked very impressive. And I found that their main ailments were malaria and machete cuts. However, I had noticed that the wives of one of the Indians was getting a little bit larger as time went on, and I knew at once that she was pregnant. And I knew that I would have to face up to this problem sooner or later. So one night, the Indian came in and said that his wife had very great stomach trouble. I knew then that I was going to have to deliver a baby. Well, I put on my white coat, went down to this Indian hut, and I recall very vividly that after the first one, the one popped out, I knew that there should be some sort of an afterbirth. But it never happened. In a short while, the second one popped out. And so I delivered twins. I say I delivered twins, but I think I got more in the way than anything else. But there's one thing about that that I remember. I read in books by writers who traveled in the jungles and far out of way places that they were the first white men the Indians had ever seen. Well, I know of only one authentic case. I was the first white man that those two little Indian babies had ever seen.
No, that's true.
Yeah.
Well, now we've got the place where, do we get You're close to Purdue now, 28 years. Did you go from Columbia to Purdue, or did you have another assignment?
No, I came from Columbia to Purdue.
Is Columbia, incidentally, very much the same university that you knew in the 20s and 30s?
Well, I don't know too well, because I haven't been back very often. I did when I first came to Purdue to conclude the work of my graduate students, and then it seemed very much the same. But I understand from reading the alumni magazines and other material which they set out that there's been very marked changes, not only in the administration, but also in the participation of students in the administrative affairs of the university.
Were you there in the days of Nicholas Murray Butler?
Oh, yes. I got to know Nicholas Murray Butler fairly well.
What kind of an educator was he?
Well, I look upon him as being the last of the educator-administrator type of presidents of universities, because he was a scholar and an administrator as well. Though he was quite egotistical, I think, and pretty much of a stuffed shirt on occasion, but otherwise he was a real scholar and administrator. Of course, he was dictatorial, and the faculty accepted the fact that he was so because of his scholarship and standing in the academic world and also in the political world. Now, you may recall that he was placed in nomination for the Republican nomination for the presidency of the Republican Party, and Theodore Roosevelt had looked upon Nicholas Murray Butler as his possible successor.
I was not aware of that.
And he addressed the convention.
This is time before World War One, when.
No. This is after.
You mean Franklin D. Roosevelt?
No. This is Theodore Roosevelt had backed him many years before and looked upon him as his possible successor. Now, this is long before World War One, but
Wilson entered the picture then.
Wilson, Taft and Wilson entered the picture, and then the convention which nominated Harding was the one in which his name was placed in nomination, and he led on the first two ballots. But then it became evident that he could not win.
That's interesting.
Yep.
Quite a man.
He was that, yes.
You know the story of Wilson and Butler. Butler teasing Wilson about having the house plan or the quadrangle plan at Princeton.
No,
looking after all the sissies and the sons of the rich, you know, coddling them.
Yes.
And Wilson said, I have biblical authority that my job is not as difficult as President Butler's. Butler said, how come? Wilson said, doth it not say in the scriptures that the keeper of Israel shall neither slumber nor sleep?
No, I never heard that story.
Well, you came to Purdue after the war, World War II. Did you stay at Columbia during World War II?
No, I had retained my reserve officership in the Air Corps, but had finally given it up. But in as much as I'd had very number of years of experience in the jungle, I was made chief of exploration of the United States government rubber exploration in the Amazon Valley in Brazil.
In so, 41 or 40?
In 1942, just after shortly after the war was declared. It was believed that there were tremendous wild rubber resources in the Amazon Valley, particularly up in the Mato Grosso.
That was at the time, wasn't it, when we needed rubber?
Yes, the rubber.
I remember giving old rubber mats and
yes.
Rubber girdles and so on to the effort.
So I had with me 28 forest rangers who were either too large or too small to get into any of the armed services. And we undertook then a survey of the parts of Mato Grosso where rubber was reported to be fairly abundant. And so I had 2 years of that work in the jungles of Brazil, which to me was highly interesting because of being in the vicinity where many of the Indians were, who had had very little or no contact with white man or civilization. I had as my interpreter and foreman a Mr. Rondon, who was a son of General Rondon, who accompanied Theodore Roosevelt into the Mato Grosso and was with him when he discovered the River of Doubt. And from his son, I got a great deal of interesting things about his father, who was what we might call the Commissioner of Indian Affairs in Brazil for a great number of years.
Are they exterminating the Indians there? Do you hear this as a gossip? Were they in your day?
No, I wouldn't say they were exterminating the Indians, because the Mato Grosso is such a vast area that it was very difficult to make any extermination there. Although most of the Brazilians that I had contact with, at least, felt that the Indians should be driven out from certain areas, but they thought it never could be done because the Indians were so vicious and they were afraid of them. I recall that I had great difficulty with getting Brazilians working for me because we were in the Indian territory and they were very much afraid of being in contact with the Indians.
Did they have good cause?
Yes, they had good
cause. These were rough Indians.
Yes, they were rough Indians. I was very much interested after time in a group that I had working for me. These were Indians, and there was one old chap whom I regard as a foreman of about 15 Indians. They were very good workers, and he was a very congenial person. Finally, he approached me to sell some shrunken heads. And I looked over, he had about 10 or 15 there. But when I saw he had one shrunken head with red hair, I knew it wasn't an Indian. So I later found out he'd been a headhunter himself. And I actually saw on one occasion the shrinking of a head of an Indian. They're very adept at doing it. Of course, you know, they remove the skull. They cut the skin around the neck and then up from the back to the center of the head, and then they gradually peel the skin and the flesh off, and finally they've got all but the bony skull. And then they sew it back up and fill it with hot sand and hold it over a fire and begin to smoke it. At the same time, they knead the skin with oil so as to keep wrinkles out as much as possible, and they pull out hairs to make the hair conform somewhat to the size of the skull as it then shrinks. It's quite a long time process.
Does it have a religious significance? Is it totemic significance?
Oh no, I don't think so. At least that's not the impression I got. I thought that it was just a manifestation of an expression of the superiority of one tribe over another. Yeah. This happened at that time. It was reported to happen quite frequently that although headhunting was outlawed, it went on back and forth in the bush, a sort of reciprocal process, so to speak.
Did you get any rubber, find any rubber for us?
Yes, we found quite a bit of rubber, but the cost of getting in there and getting it out would be about $8 a pound, which was entirely prohibited.
I mean, not even wartime. It didn't warrant it during wartime.
I don't think so. Of course, the native rubber leaders had a lot of rubber on hand. This was a business going on up in the jungles, and we arranged to get this rubber out down to Manaus and to the States.
You were in deeper than Manaus.
Oh, very much deeper. Went up the Madeira River to a little place, a village called Porto Velho, and then beyond that about 200 miles, went deep into the Mato Grosso. One time we were very close to the border of Bolivia.
And you were really in deep.
Oh yes, yes, we were.
You did everything by boat or did you walk?
By walk. And we carried all our supplies for 30 men on our backs.
Let me just ask. The other thing I know about that is you tried to novel Green Mansions by Hudson.
Oh, yes.
Does that have any relevance? Is that,
well,
or was that an idealization?
I think that was an idealization.
Yeah. Well, you came back. Did you stay there from 44, 45? Came back in 45.
I came back in 45, back to Colombia, because I was fed up with the waste of federal money and the lack of effort from central headquarters in Manaus. And it got to the point where I wrote a letter to Mr. Truman, who was then chairman of a very influential committee in the Senate, telling what I had observed as to the waste of federal money in this whole project. And so I got so fed up, if I may use that word, with the whole process that I asked to be relieved.
I'm interested in one thing. Did a lot of this money have to go for cooperation to get the Brazilians to work?
Oh, yes. Oh, my, the amount of graft that went on. Let's call it graft. I mean, the handouts to the Brazilian government were just tremendous, you see. They bled the Chico Development Corporation for everything they could get.
Yeah. I shouldn't doubt it.
Yeah.
Well, of course, Uncle Sam's very rich.
Oh, yes. That's true.
Well, now you went back as a full professor to Columbia. Obviously, you didn't stay there because, as I remember, you came here after the war.
Yes.
As Chairman Arbenari, Department of Biology.
Right.
All right, would you tell us how you came and what your job was when you came? Because as I told you before we went on the tape, Mr. Hudley said you're responsible for reshaping and redirecting the biological efforts at Purdue.
Well, I'm not so sure about that, but I'll let that stand.
All right.
My coming to Purdue was entirely fortuitous. I had no intention of leaving Columbia because I was very comfortably placed as a research professor. One day I received a letter from Mr. Ayers from Purdue University, who had been just recently made Secretary of the Mathematical Association of America. And at that time, I was Secretary of the Union of American Biological Societies and the Botanical Society of America. And he wrote inquiring as to how I conducted the work as a Secretary of these organizations. And he said he'd be in New York City on a certain date. Could he come up and see me? We arranged a date. He came up and we talked about the secretarial direction. Particularly that of an executive secretary of an organization. And then he mentioned quite casually that Dean Andrews at Purdue had retired and asked if I would be interested in Purdue University. I told him at once I was not, because I was going on leave of absence and I was quite comfortable at Columbia University. But he asked if I would come out to Purdue and look over the biology department and make recommendations as to who might be a good head for the Department of Biological Sciences. I named four or five people, and I understand later that none of them were acceptable or didn't want to come to Purdue. And then I went on leave of absence to the Chesapeake Biological Station, and while there, I received another letter from Dean Ayers asking if I would come out again and be a consultant on the Life Science Building, the plans of which were being made at that time. So I came out, and subsequently another time. In the meantime, Ayers had pressed very strongly that I come, but I resisted to the extent that I was sort of weakening. And then Mr. Hovde came to see me, or he didn't come to see me, but he wrote me a letter telling me what he wanted to be to do with biology. And so the upshot was we came out here. So it was entirely accidental in a sense.
In what year?
That was late 47.
Roughly, what did Hovde want you to do?
Well, Hovde made that statement that the first half of this century belonged to physics and chemistry, and the second half would be biology. And he promised that if I came, he would go as far out as possible for the development of biological sciences. And he stated that he would back up the recruitment of new staff and other aspects for the development.
Did he particularly want botany or zoology, or was he interested in biochemistry or biophysics?
No, he was interested in biology in general. He made no specific comments as to a particular area of biology to be developed. And so we came out here. And I might say we've never regretted it.
Well, when you got here, you had administrative problems and academic problems. Supposing we take those more or less and divide them. Of course, two oftentimes about the same. But in administration, what was the problem you had to face there?
Well, I would say the first and foremost problem was the recruitment of new staff. I might say that the job of becoming head of a department at Purdue was one of the easiest that I can possibly imagine, because in my estimation at least, biology had just about hit the bottom, and there was no place it could go except up. It did not stay on the bottom, so that anything anyone did that was at least commendable would be upward. And therefore, the job, in my estimation, was one of the best jobs to be had.
Now, does this mean that there was not a purposeful organization? There wasn't distinguished graduate work? In other words, as I remember it, the courses were kind of courses that students took, resembled very much the courses students would have taken in 1900.
Well, not quite that, but you're not very far away from that. You see, it was what I might call classical biology. Mm-hmm. And if I might say this, with due respect to Dean Enders, he was also the Dean of the School of Science and Dean of the Department of Biological Sciences. And as I've been told, he was sort of the whipping boy for President Eliot. And when chemistry and physics especially made heavy demands on him, I've been told that he sometimes took money that was designated for the biological sciences and gave it to physics and chemistry, with the result that biology was not getting its due share under the administration of Dean Enders, although he was a biologist. But pressure was put on him, as I understand it. Now, the first problem was recruitment of staff. Then I would say the next problem.
Well, may I interrupt there?
Yes.
In recruiting the staff, you must have something in mind that certain areas, let's say bacteriology or parasitology, either need strengthening or the way Purdue is operating, you must have the best men in the country in this area to work with, let us say, with biology and agriculture.
Yes.
Or biochem.
That's right.
Did this kind of thing, was this part of the problem?
Well, this is part of the problem of, in a sense, being aware of current trends in biology and getting new staff members in those particular areas. Now, at that time, bacteriology, I would say, were the strongest group in the biology department. And botany was fairly strong. Zoology, with the exception of possibly two members, was probably the weakest. So one of the problems then was building up in the field of zoology, and particularly building staff members, bringing in staff members or recruiting staff members and that were aware of the advancements in these various fields.
And who would also do the job of publishing papers.
That's right. Well, I was going to come to that. After the recruiting of staff, I would say one of the problems that I faced up to right away was to try to get increases in salary for those staff members that merited it, so that they would have a feeling of confidence in the head of the department and the way the department was to go. Then came the problem of orienting the staff towards research, because at that time the teaching load was so heavy that staff members had very little time for research, and they were not encouraged or oriented towards research. So one of the problems was trying to reduce the teaching load, so that staff members who were interested in research could do research. And this involved a change in the curriculum to a certain extent, and orienting it towards the new developments in biology. It also involved a problem that came rather severe after a while of during a wave of duplication between Department of Biological Sciences and the Department of Botany in the School of Agriculture. Both departments were offering similar courses and duplicating efforts. It is very interesting that prior to Dean Skinner, there were no courses being taught in the School of Agriculture. And therefore, when students there wanted, let's say, a course in plant pathology, Professor Porter was asked to set up a course in plant pathology. Well, the result was that we had six courses in plant pathology. Botany had four courses in elementary botany. We had five courses in elementary botany. So I said, to agriculture, you turn over the elementary botany to us and we'll give you that plant pathology. But empires are within a university.
They're hard to destroy sometimes.
Hard to destroy. So this was quite a problem. Well, to get the staff really oriented toward research meant the search for research money, grants of every sort. And I recall the Christmas holidays of the first year I was here. I spent almost 3 weeks in the East visiting foundations in New York, in Washington, and wherever there seemed to be a possibility to get research grants. In a sense, I surveyed the field and found out where money might be available, provided worthy research projects were drawn up by the staff members. This proved to be very successful. And at that time, the National Science Foundation had been in existence for a number of years, but the appropriations from Congress were very small. But as they increased, more money was available, and we drew up a number of research projects which were approved, and so we got started on the flow of research money into the department.
In what areas?
Well, primarily, at the beginning, in screening for antibiotics. That was a big field at that time. And then in bordering areas of biochemistry and molecular biology. That was the emerging field, or had emerged, but it was not consciously thought to be so here at Purdue. Oh, so one of the problems then was getting research money for the staff members who had worthy research projects. Then I would say another problem which presented itself, and naturally would so, what to do about staff members who were not amenable to much change or wanted to do research, but continued the teaching of courses as they had taught them for at least 2 decades. I had several conferences with President Houghton and Dean Ayers at that time about such staff members, as well as the graduate dean, E.C. Young. And they recognized that it was quite a problem throughout the university. Their recommendation was to bypass it as much as possible. And that those who had tenure could not be released, and we had to continue on the staff.
But you didn't have to assign them either research assistants or money.
No, and there were very, very sparse increases in salaries. I tried for years to get Dean Ayers to at least agree to increase the salary of one assistant professor $100 a year for the rest of the time he was on the staff. But Dean Ayers was adamant, and I don't blame him, because this particular staff member was not worthy of increases, I thought.
Well,
you
were head of the department how many years?
Well, 47 to 59. And 12, one of the... One
12
of the,
years. Now, things changed. I remember it changed very radically.
Yes.
I have heard, you never said this to me, but I have heard that you turned our department, or the department became internationally known for its expertise and its research.
Well,
during this period.
I can't claim credit for that. I was, as new staff members came in, they were a constant needle to me. And I, they knew almost better than I did what was really happening in biology at Harvard, Columbia, California, and all of those places, you see.
I remember a man, a very charming gentleman, Mr. Zorro, who was here, came from Harvard and stayed, and is now gone back where he has more facilities to do his own research. He's back at Connecticut,
that's
University
right.
of Connecticut.
Yes.
But are we talking about this kind of man?
Well, I would say Zorro was one. And several others that we brought in were of the same type, and they made proposals, and we discussed them quite fully in the department, and it was decided to go this way and that, so that I would say that the contribution that I made was to take their proposals to the central administration with the backing of these people. So I would say that the turning around of the department is primarily due to the new staff members we brought in who had the ideas of what should be done.
In other words, you had, in a sense, an easy job. You didn't have to build a lot of fire. The fire was there.
The fire was there after we got five or six new staff members. And my contribution was implementation, primarily, you see. So it wasn't an extremely difficult job in any sense. I might say this as a corollary. I was hired to come to Purdue, as were all staff members, to teach and do research. And I held to that concept. I continued my research and my teaching, which were the primary purposes why I was brought here. And I must say that I devoted a minimum time to what we call paper pushing. And I'm quite sure that several of the minor administrative officials over in the administrative building thought I was a hell of an administrator. And I kept reminding them that, first of all, I was a professor and not an administrator. And that was my basic philosophy, that a university consists primarily of professors and students, and that administration should be a service department to the rest of the university. This was the environment in which I grew up at Columbia, and I still hold to that philosophy that the administration should not run the university, they should serve the university, be a service organization for the university. So I think a lot of the minor people in the administrative department thought I was a hell of an administrator because I carried out the function that I thought was essential to running a department, staff and students.
Did you have a hand in getting the new life science building?
Yes. You see, I was called out as a consultant on the planning of the life science building as far as biology was concerned. And President Hogde was very anxious to integrate all of the biological sciences throughout the university and the accessory impinging sciences into one building, you see. And the planning of the building, in his estimation, should be such that physiologists in agriculture, in horticulture, and biological sciences should be in close proximity, and that there should be very close intercourse or communication between physiologists wherever they were on the university. The same is true of the botanists and the animal science and so on. So we were all placed in one building, and it was fervent hope of President Hogde that we'd all work together as one unit, although in separate departments. And as you know, each department is an empire. And although we have been in close proximity for years now, there isn't the communication that we thought there would be between the closely related aspects of the biological sciences.
Well, now, you became a distinguished professor. What is the title of your distinguished professorship?
John Wright, Distinguished Professor in Biological Research.
And you've been having a ball?
Oh, I certainly have.
Doing research?
Yes.
Are you teaching at all?
I now hold the anomalous position of curator of the herbarium. Now that is a peculiar position throughout biology, wherever you go. When a professor retires, and they would like to have his services on, in a certain extent, to make him a curator. Well, my appointment as a distinguished professor is I would say the result of a number of conditions. I believe that if a man in a head position can't make his big contribution within 10 years or a decade, he ought to get out. Well, when this question came up, I just about had it in such terms. And I had been very fortunate in having within the department a very outstanding young man. And I'd indicated Professor Hovde, when I came here, that I would serve as head of the department for only 10 years. And when the day of the 10th year came up, I called Mr. Hovde and said, Fred, do you know what day this is? And he said, how the hell should I know? I said, well, it's 10 years ago since I came, and as of tomorrow, I'm resigning. He said, hold on, wait a minute. Well, we talked it over, and I said I had a very excellent young man that he knew quite well, who could take over, and that was better oriented than myself in the developments and the direction biology was taking. And therefore, I thought he should be head of the department. Well, I stayed on for a few months, and in the meantime, he called up and said that they had had a contribution, and that would I accept the chair of the John Wright Professorship of Biological Sciences. And so I said, I certainly will. So that was it. And but I continued on. He said, distinguished professor, as I interpreted from the conversation with President Hovde, was he could do very much what he wanted to, but make contributions to the university. So I continued to teach one course and do research. And then about that time, when I was ready for retirement, the UNESCO was organizing an expedition to survey the protean resources of the Indian Ocean. And I was asked to go on this expedition known as the UNESCO Indian Ocean, International Indian Ocean Expedition. I was to go to study, as far as possible, the diseases of the fishes of the Indian Ocean. Well, the UNESCO had made arrangements with President Kennedy, and he agreed to turn over the presidential yacht, the Williamsburg, to this expedition. And the NASA Science Foundation gave $10 million to recondition this presidential yacht into the best oceanographic vessel in existence at that time. So this was the facilities for the expedition. I went on it, and for a while I tried to work microscopically on the oceanographic vessel, but the vibrations of the diesel engines are very slight, magnified up to 3,000 times, is just too much for microscopic work. So I took a station at the tip of India.
You're down on the very tip.
Very tip. And worked there for the allotted time which I had agreed upon for the Indian Ocean expedition. So then I came back to Purdue University again and continued my research. But then I had a request from the Madras University at Madras, India, to come or accept the visiting Sir C. V. Raman Nobel Laureate Visiting Professorship of Biology. So in the Indian Ocean Expedition was in 63. I went back to India in 64 and 65 and was the visiting professor in Madras University for that time. And Then I came back to Purdue again, but I had submitted a project to the Fulbright committee to make a study of Satan fungi in New Zealand and Australia. And this research project was approved, so in 65 and 66 I was in New Zealand studying fungi, which were very important, causing facial eczema in sheep and cattle. So I returned from that, and outside of visits, three visits to Europe and one to Mexico, I've been at Purdue.
Didn't you also lecture in Jamaica once?
Oh yes, I was in 57 and 58. I was visiting professor at the University of West, West Indies University at outside of Kingston, Jamaica. That's right.
You've pretty well been everywhere except in the north of Europe or central Europe to lecture and to study.
Yes.
Well, that's an interesting career. Now, you've put nothing on here about your family. You just mentioned your wife and your daughter.
Well, I married quite late. I just by accident met this young lady from Virginia up in Connecticut. And the result was that we're married. We have one daughter who is now living in Chicago, who is married. I go back to Texas once and sometimes twice a year. The ranch was left under my administration. There are 64 people, descendants, who have an interest in the ranch. So I go back usually in the spring to distribute the 64 portions of the shares in the ranch. Some have, the only common denominator that we could agree on was 144. So some of them have two 144th shares, some have 15, some have 20. So the income is distributed according to the proportion.
You raise cattle?
We raise cattle and horses and my brother, who's now 89, has been running the place in a sense, but he's getting very feeble, and we're selling off more and more as years go by.
Will there be anybody in the family to take care of it after you?
No, I think not. We'll just sell off the whole thing, and I think we'll have to sell it off because taxes are becoming so exorbitant, and the price of the land has gone up so high that when it was bought for 45 cents an acre in 1879, it's now up in the thousands.
Well, that's what happens.
Yeah.
Now, for the tape, we will append the list of your publications and books. About how many articles have you had published in your career?
I think it's about 176 or close to 180. And then there are five books.
And does this include reports on your archaeological expedition?
None.
As I understand, among your distinguished honors, you are a fellow of the Royal Society.
Yes, which is to me a laughable matter, because it came about by my accidental archaeological discoveries, finding something that I wasn't looking for.
Well. Before we go off the tape, what is the future of the biological sciences in this university or elsewhere?
Well, the way biology is going now, and I think Purdue Biological Sciences is in the leadership, and it's going in the direction of emerging with biochemistry, and it has been for a great number of years, in particular with the field of large molecules like the DNA molecule, RNA, and so on, and even going beyond that to the subunits of these large molecules. Also, emphasis now in the department is on, I would say, ecology and the conservation of our environment. And this involves not only research, but a teaching curriculum that emphasizes to the students the interrelationship of man to his environment and the fact that he cannot continue to disabuse his environment and survive.
Is this the general trend of biological sciences?
It is now throughout the country.
And internationally?
Yes, yes.
All right, I always ask this question of every former head. How do you rate Purdue's biology in the Big Ten?
Well, I would say that in several fields, it's just about tops.
What would you name it?
Molecular biology, biochemistry, and ecology at the present time. Well,
who would compete with us in the Big Ten in the area of biology?
I would rate Indiana and Wisconsin.
Not Chicago, Northwestern.
No.
Of course, these ratings go up and down according to the research and the staff. But
well, as a staff retires now, Cornell used to be tops in the field of botany.
Yeah.
And they had the great outstanding men. And then they retired and fell. And at Columbia, with E.B. Wilson, Morgan, and Harper, and several others, that was the golden period of biology at Columbia. They retired. Columbia biology went down. So it's up and down the time, you see. Huh?
Nationally, how would you put us? Among the first 10 schools?
Yes, I would.
Among the first 10?
Yes, I think so.
Well, let's just take them in the East, what are your major departments at the moment?
Well, I have to come back to MIT and Harvard, and I would rate Columbia in that group, and Yale, not so much Princeton. Well, you see, I'm...
Again,
I'm almost entirely Ivy League.
Yes.
But, well, I would rate California and Stanford with Harvard at the present time, because Harvard is now having retirement of a number of outstanding professors.
What about your southern universities?
Difficult for me to say because I'm not very familiar.
You have to keep up with the literature, don't you?
That's right.
In several areas.
Yes, that's right.
It's a little hard to do. Yeah. Well, now, is there something on change in university life that you'd like to comment on? Certainly, in your experience, the universities between 1918 and the present time, you must have seen revolutions on those.
Well, I'll say this again, that the change I would like to see is the recognition, particularly in the Big Ten, that the university is composed of its faculty and its students, and that the administration should not play the dominant role in the running of the university. I recall an incident, this happened to be when Eisenhower was president of Columbia. He issued a directive to the faculty, and the upshot was the threat of some of the outstanding professors to resign. Well, Eisenhower, who was a fish out of water as a university president, called a group of professors in about this thing, and he made the statement that he was not aware that this directive had antagonized the employees of the university. Robbie, the Nobel laureate, stood up very proudly and said, "Mr. General, we are not employees of the university, we are the university." I think that sums up my attitude and what I would like to see a change.
Are the undergraduates any brighter than they were? Do they come better equipped for biology?
Oh, yes, certainly they do.
What is this do mathematics in high school are due to biological courses in public schools?
Well, the American Institute of Biological Sciences, in which I was very much involved in establishing between the years of 42 and 47, has completely modified or changed by its series of textbooks and so on, the teaching biology in the high schools. So they come very much better prepared than, let's say, we were as students.
Now, as I remember, you know what you're doing in this, because don't you correct the examinations for placement?
Well, I got involved very early in 54 in the advanced placement program of the College Entrance Examination Board. So I was a reader, they call them, and then I became chairman of the examining committee. And I stayed with this from 54 to 66, so I was very conscious of what was happening in the high schools.
In other words, it's the textbooks and teachers that have done it.
Yes, that's true.
Well, this is interesting, that the world of biology and science becomes alive and that they are coming better prepared.
They are that. And yet, I sense a tendency in high schools for the teachers to avoid what I call the fundamentals of biology and teach to a great extent the latest developments without the background that would help the understanding of those latest developments, you see. It's just like teaching a football squad a lot of plays without having the background of fundamentals of football and defense and offense.
It's a little like Professor Bakarovitz once remarked about his son coming from the University of Chicago talking about a very deep research problem in physics until Mr. Horowitz said he sat there with his mouth open until he had married and mentioned the periodic table and his son said, "What's that?"
Yes. Then, while I was on the College Board, a very interesting development got started, and I served on this council for 4 years. This was advanced examination for advanced college examinations called CLEP now, a program which was initiated and curricula established that would get credit to any person, whether it was a housewife looking at TV or a workman or anybody reading books, could take examinations by university to enter the university. And this program has grown by leaps and bounds in the last few years.
Wonderful. Well, is there anything more we could put on?
No, I don't think of anything more. I've just about covered it.
All right.
Well, I might say this in relation to my coming to Purdue. Of course, when the question came up, I went in to see Mr. Eisenhower several times, and I remember the first time I went in to see him, he stood up and said almost at once, "I see you've been here at Columbia 28 years, you ought to be retired." So I said, "It's quite all right, I'm ready, Mr. President." And we talked a lot, and he said, "Well now, if you come to talk about education with me, you might as well get the hell out of here because I don't know anything about it." Well, I went in to see him several times, and the last time I saw him, he reached a point that frequently comes up in conversation. No one has anything more to say. So he asked me, if he could do anything for me, and I said, "No, I've just about decided to go to Purdue." And he said, "Fine." He said, "Why don't you get the hell out of this big city?" Well,
you agreed with that.
I agreed with it, yes. New York has changed a lot in the 28 years. We hadn't realized it until we came out here.
Well, this is the end of an interview on July 13, 1972, in the offices of Professor John R. Carling with R.B. Eccles, the Department of History. The interview is for the Purdue University Archives. Thank you very much, Professor Carling.
Okay.